Just a small fraction of our region's energy comes from solar.
The industry was somewhat slow to get on its feet.
But workers, homeowners, and communities are putting up solar arrays all over, challenging people to find out what they're missing.
It creates the momentum that people need to see that, how come I don't have that?
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, can a growing solar industry power and empower a region still dependent on fossil fuels? Plus, as administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, it's Scott Pruitt's job to enforce environmental regulations. But how he does that is up to him and his philosophy.
We have a responsibility to manage and cultivate, harvest, the natural resources that we've been blessed with.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. A multi-state commission that sets standards for sewage and industrial waste in the Ohio River has voted to move forward with a proposal to eliminate its pollution control standards. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports.
The Ohio River Valley Water Sanitation Commission, known as ORSANCO, is supposed to ensure the river is safe for drinking, fishing, and recreation. Director Richard Harrison says many of the protections that the board voted to consider eliminating are already addressed by state and federal regulations.
That has been the focus of the commission, to make sure that our program is not redundant, that it's the best use of our resources.
But one report finds 188 instances where state rules are not redundant to ORSANCO's. Gail Hess is with the National Wildlife Federation.
The vote is a shameful retreat for the officials charged with the environmental stewardship of the Ohio River.
Board members from Ohio and West Virginia voted yes to move forward with eliminating the standards, but the Pennsylvania DEP representative voted no. More public hearings are to begin this month before a final vote in October. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Steel mills and coal mines once powered the economy of the Laurel Highlands. Amid the collapse of those industries, some Cambria County residents are looking to build jobs around clean energy to help revitalize the region. Reporting for State Impact Pennsylvania, WESA's Amy Sisk has more.
Surrounded by steep hills and rivers, Johnstown is home to 20,000 people, the hub of Cambria County.
We have four robust seasons here.
It's a spring day, almost 80 degrees, and Alan Cashaw is sitting on a bench in the middle of town.
It gets really hot when it's hot and gets really cold when it's cold. And both of those, you know, draw on utilities.
Money is tight for many in this community plagued by job losses and a drop in population. Cashaw is a retired chemical engineer and heads a local branch of the NAACP. One focus is economic sustainability. On that note, he's been cooking up an idea.
This one looks at a grassroots solution to growing the economy here in the area by freeing up monies that are spent on utilities to purchase other things.
Cashaw has worked on this with another resident, Tom Schuster. They're calling it Re-Energize Johnstown, part of a broader effort to reinvent the community as industry jobs wane.
I think a lot of people were kind of focused on how do we bring that back, and I think that there's finally, you know, a realization that it's not going to go back to the way it was. You know, for us to thrive, we have to go a different path.
Schuster works for the Sierra Club, but he spends a lot of free time focused on this initiative.
There's a lot going on in terms of economic development and jobs in the country and in the state on clean energy, but not as much here.
Schuster and Cashaw have two goals under Re-Energize Johnstown. One, to promote energy efficiency by helping residents with home upgrades. The other has to do with this sign in Schuster's yard.
It says, "Go Solar" with the Cambria County Solar Co-op.
This co-op is a partnership with Solar United Neighbors. Henry McKay is the Pennsylvania Program Director. He just held a meeting in Johnstown to jumpstart the group.
We had 50 people show up. There was a lot of enthusiasm.
Solar United Neighbors has developed a model used across 9 states to bolster solar energy within a community. It looks for a commitment from at least 20 people who go in together for bids from installers.
There are better financing options out there that let you essentially borrow money to pay for the cost of the insulation and then pay back that loan with your energy savings. So that means it is increasingly affordable for a broader kind of swath of incomes.
Kesha plans to put solar panels on his rooftop through the co-op to set the example along with other members.
It creates the momentum that people need to see that, how come I don't have that?
A half hour to the north, retired science teacher Rick Bloom knows that reaction. He's given a lot of tours of the solar system on his family farm. As he walks closer to the barn, you can hear a hum. It's from the inverters wired to solar panels installed on the roof in 2011.
You can read on these, it tells you how much electricity. This thing's making, it's making 3,482 watts right now per hour. So that's a fair amount.
Over time, those panels produce most of the electricity his house needs. Bloom says he'd love to see other Cambria County residents go solar, particularly in Johnstown.
Where Johnstown goes sort of takes the rest of the county along with it. So, you know, if we can make Johnstown better, it's going to help the rest of the county.
But he says that alone won't solve the region's economic woes.
I think it's one of those deals where it's going to be a whole lot of little things. You know, I don't think like solar energy development is going to make a huge impact, but it's going to make a small impact.
Solar power, more efficient homes, better recreation opportunities, more cultural events. All things Johnstown is pursuing to make a turnaround. Amy Sisk, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Later, we'll hear from someone who finally made his dream of working in the solar industry happen. But first, President Trump has promised to help the coal industry. But can he? He's asking his administration to draw up plans to keep struggling coal and nuclear plants running. Though the plans haven't been finalized yet, the message is clear. The Trump administration wants to keep them open. To learn more about this, our own energy reporter, Reid Frazier, is here. Hi, Reid.
Hey, Kara.
So President Trump has asked Energy Secretary Rick Perry to move forward with a bailout for coal and nuclear plants. What's this bailout look like?
Well, just a little background. Coal and nuclear plants are really struggling to make it in the market with the cheap prices of natural gas. And increasingly, renewable energy is also hurting the coal and nuclear plants. So what the administration is exploring is some type of maybe ratepayers would pay more for their electricity so that these plants can keep running and cover their costs.
Okay, I feel like we've heard this before. Secretary Perry last year described the closing of coal and nuclear plants as a national security risk because of grid insecurity that might follow and was looking for a similar bailout, I think. And so I know you did some reporting about this at the time.
Yeah, I mean, what's new here, so to back up, yes, Rick Perry did propose a rule that would essentially have ratepayers subsidize coal and nuclear plants. And the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission denied that request. This version now adds a component of national security through something called the Defense Production Act, which was actually signed by Harry S. Truman during the Korean War. And basically, it is meant to provide the military with whatever it needs from the economy, be it materials or services, during a time of war.
The president's order is exactly the criticism that many conservatives had with the Clean Power Plan, that it favors one industry over another. You know, in that case, it was renewables over coal.
That's exactly right. And, you know, the phrase that you hear a lot in this business is picking winners, that the government shouldn't be, in charge of picking winners in terms of what kinds of electricity we produce. But one kind of funny thing about this whole situation is that Energy Secretary Rick Perry, a Republican, you know, he came out and said there is no free market for electricity when he rolled this plan out originally in the fall. Basically, that the government has a large say in how we make electricity. And in a way, he's exactly right. You know, whether it be a foreign policy that we enact or regulations about finances or taxes or environmental regulations, the government does put its thumb on the scale in terms of what kinds of electricity we use.
Okay, so how will this affect us on a local level? What about coal plants, coal jobs here in Pennsylvania?
Well, if it goes through, and that's a big if, what you could see is several plants that are in danger of closing down. They might be able to hold on for a few years. But there's a chance that even if it does go through, the subsidy that these plants would get might not be enough to save them. Like a big nuclear plant, like say Three Mile Island or First Energy's Beaver Valley plant near Pittsburgh, if there's not enough money in it for them, they may just, you know, those plants are slated to close in the next few years. Their owners may say, we're just going to still keep them closed.
Thanks, but no thanks.
Thanks, but no thanks. If it does go through, one, you know, potential upshot of this is that we'll pay more money for our electricity here to support these plants and keep them online. That's a point that the opponents of any bailout keep bringing up.
Okay, thanks, Reed.
Thank you.
Reed Frazier covers energy and many other topics at the Allegheny Front, and he contributes to State Impact Pennsylvania. Check out our website for more on this story, as well as Reed's latest reporting on Pennsylvania's updated methane regulations for the gas industry. That's all at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. People who work in the solar industry sometimes have to walk a fine line. Not every potential customer is a tree hugger or a liberal looking to fight climate change.
I try to keep things on a politically neutral basis and focus on the environmental benefits, but also on the financial benefits.
Later on the Allegheny Front, we get some insight into the growing solar industry from a worker who had to convince his own family that it was a good career move. Stay tuned. Butternut trees are threatened by a fungal disease that eventually kills them. It can be hard to find one that's not already affected, which is why ecologists at the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy were so excited by a recent discovery in Frick Park. The Allegheny Front's Andy Cubis has more.
Keep walking in a little bit more.
The forest behind the Frick Environmental Center is lush, but walk about 500 feet along the Clayton Hill Trail and you come to a clearing.
Yeah, it looks a little bit shocking when you first see it. Every open space you see, there used to be a tree.
This is Judith Cook. She coordinates volunteer landscape projects for the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy. Cook worked on a restoration project in this area of the park all winter. The original plan was to get rid of a giant stand of invasive honeysuckle that had taken over.
In this whole area, you couldn't see anything. It was just a wall of honeysuckle. It was so crazy.
The honeysuckle in this patch of forest likely escaped from someone's yard and had been growing unchecked for about 2 decades. But once it was cleared, the park staff found a pleasant surprise. 10 strong, full-grown butternut trees. Cook stands in the clearing and points up to one.
Here you see a perfectly healthy butternut that I've never really seen before in Pittsburgh parks, growing perfectly fine in our woodlands the way they're supposed to.
You rarely find a healthy butternut because of a deadly exotic fungus that creates a fatal disease called butternut canker. In some states, 80% of the butternuts have already died. The trees, also known as white walnuts, used to be widespread in Pennsylvania's forests, and their nuts are an important food source for wildlife. When a butternut gets canker, it develops an oblong-shaped abscess that oozes. The wounds eventually cut off the tree's nutrient supply, and it dies. According to the Parks Conservancy, every butternut in Frick Park shows symptoms of the disease, except for these newly discovered ones. That's why it's such an important find.
There are just so many threats to our native trees that seeing trees that are not diseased, that are withstanding something that is spreading throughout the country and taking out the entire species, that is a big deal to us. I'm not sure if it's such a big deal to the public, though.
What's your best guess for why these don't have canker?
We don't really know why they don't have canker. The reason why we're interested in them is we are interested in their genetic makeup. We want to see if they are maybe not susceptible to the canker or just a little bit stronger than other butternuts.
The healthy butternuts will be closely monitored for the next couple years for any signs of the fungus. If they remain canker-free, Parks Conservancy staff will collect their DNA and add it to a genetic database of the city's strongest trees. And they'll also grow new trees that will be used to repopulate this site. For now, the hard work of forest restoration continues. Today there's a chainsaw to help, but often it's just a lot of old-fashioned hand weeding, to keep the site free of invasives, like that pesky honeysuckle that's already creeping back.
What's next here? What are you going to be looking for, and what are you going to be doing?
We will continue going out here with interns and with volunteers and with staff and removing as many invasive as we can as they are regrowing. So ideally, in like 2 to 3 years, we can start planting restoration trees on the site to start filling in the canopy.
Cook says the project will take at least 10 years, but when they're done, the tree canopy will be closed, they hope, by a bunch of healthy, canker-free butternut trees.
That is like one of the greatest things about Pittsburgh, that we're so green and we have so many parks. So it's really important that we preserve them and make them stronger.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Andy Kubis.
How do our beliefs manifest themselves in our everyday lives, like at our jobs? This is not just an existential question, but one we tried to answer in the latest episode of our podcast, Trump on Earth. Before Scott Pruitt was administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency or the Attorney General of Oklahoma, he was a suburban lawyer with big political dreams. Pruitt is a devout Christian, a Southern Baptist. Reporters Joe Wirtz of State Impact Oklahoma and Tom Dreisbach, a producer for the NPR podcast Embedded, produced a story about Scott Pruitt's early years. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier spoke with them to understand how the roots of Pruitt's beliefs and ideas about the environment might be playing out as he sets about dismantling EPA regulations.
You guys went to his hometown in Oklahoma. It's a place called Broken Arrow, which is an excellent name. He was a prominent member of a kind of megachurch there that you mentioned, the First Baptist Church, and you talked to the minister there, a guy by the name of Nick Garland.
Do you hear about God's glorious creation or the green movement or global warming or Mother Earth?
Joe, what were you guys able to find out about Pruitt by going to his church?
Pruitt is very involved in that Baptist church and still, you know, has developed this strong relationship with the with this pastor that continues to this day. They talk regularly. They pray together regularly. And Pruitt and Pruitt's family is really kind of these founding members of this church, these foundational members. Their name is on a brick in the foyer of this church, along with all these other kind of, you know, key members of the church. And it's clear that this pastor and Pruitt have this really important relationship.
Every time we come to pray for him, not only is it a great privilege to pray for the needs he's facing, but we're always amazed at his biblical insight into something he's facing. Well, to get insight, you got to spend time with God. To get biblical insight, you got to know chapter and verse.
It's clear that their interpretation of the Christian faith has a lot of influence on Pruitt and how Pruitt sees government and the role of government, ranging on all sorts of issues from abortion to the environment.
Yeah, and on the environment, I thought this was a very important point in your reporting was, you know, Scott Pruitt has an environmental philosophy that is shaped by this specific religious doctrine of the Southern Baptist Church.
The biblical worldview with respect to these issues is that we have a responsibility to manage and cultivate, harvest the natural resources that we've been blessed with to truly bless our fellow mankind.
We asked Pastor Garland about this, about the role of the church and God and the environment, and what he said is it is man's responsibility to protect the environment and to conserve the environment, but also to use the environment, that God puts the environment here, the world here, natural resources here for man, for people to use and to use to better their lives and the lives of others. And part of that message is conserving it and protecting it, but also using it. So part of being a responsible steward is using the land.
Mm-hmm. And you think about the contrast that this draws with the Catholic Church and Pope Francis in particular, who has become really kind of an advocate on issues related to climate change and the need for people to mitigate the effects and to prevent further climate change. On the other hand, you know, you have someone like Scott Pruitt, who literally wants to hold a debate about the science of climate change and, you know, he says he believes that climate change is real and that there is a man-made component to it, but that he believes the effects of it are still up for debate. One thing that you'll often hear from Scott Pruitt about what he calls the environmental left is that environmentalists want to put up a fence around all of the natural resources that we have, coal and natural gas and oil. And the environmentalists, he says, say, do not touch. And Scott Pruitt says that's completely the wrong view and that those resources are there for people to use in a responsible way, in his view, but to use nonetheless.
The environmental left tells us that though we have natural resources like natural gas and oil and coal, and though we can feed the world, we should do what? Keep those things in the ground, put up fences, and be about prohibition. That's wrongheaded. And I think it's counter to what we should be about.
Joe, I'm curious, and you know, you are from Oklahoma. There's probably more Southern Baptists in Oklahoma than there are in Pittsburgh, where I live. Is that kind of a widespread belief there, or what?
Yes, it is a widespread belief here. The Baptists are a dominant religion and political force in Oklahoma, and not just Oklahoma. It's a lot of states where these resources are abundant. Oklahoma, Texas, Alaska. It is common in a lot of places that, you know, God put this stuff on earth for man to use and to make the most of it. And part of doing right by earth and doing right by God is to use what he gave you. It's just a belief that, you know, part of conservation is, you know, conserving it because it supports you and it pays dividends. That conservation, you know, you're conserving something so it continues to support you. And people think of this the same way that you hear people talk about hunting. Mm-hmm. You know, hunters consider themselves conservationists, and indeed a lot of money from hunting goes, you know, to protect and promote the environment and wildlife and things like that. But if you talk to hunters, they will say, you know, look, part of conserving and protecting and preserving wildlife is killing wildlife and keeping, you know, that's part of the cycle. And really, I feel like those conversations that you hear from folks when they talk about the environment and natural resources and fossil fuels are very parallel to these conversations you get in with hunters, that there's oil and gas under the ground, and that stuff is there for us. We need to use it, we need to take it and preserve it, protect it, and promote it. But, you know, part of preserving that stuff that's under the ground is preserving it for us. It's here to support us, and we need to take care of it.
Reporter Joe Wirtz of State Impact Oklahoma and Tom Dreisbach, a producer for the NPR podcast Embedded, spoke with the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier for our own podcast, Trump on Earth. There's more of that conversation at trumponearth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. The solar industry is a relatively new player to Pennsylvania's energy landscape. During its infancy, making a career in it was a bit of a gamble. But Hal Saville decided to give it a go.
It was something that I had to convince my family was the right thing to do, because I had a pretty cushy job and could have retired from doing that. And it was, you know, the industry was somewhat slow to get on its feet and really gain momentum.
Saville works as a commercial energy project consultant for the company Energy Independent Solutions. He helps develop and sell solar panel systems, like the one that just went in at the Forest Hills Municipal Building near Pittsburgh. For State Impact Pennsylvania's Voices of Energy series, Saville shares his story as a crew finishes installing the system's wiring.
How's it going? Are we able to come up and join you guys up there?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is where the rubber meets the road.
I've actually been interested in solar for over 30 years. And back in the mid-80s, went to school at Penn State for solar and architectural engineering. But there was really no solar market at the time. So I had a totally different career path. Sort of got to the point where I could quit my job in IT and work for a solar company, you know, that was just getting started. I definitely was nervous, and it was a big leap of faith. I'll go out and I'll meet with the clients early on, discuss what their needs are, and kind of understand what they would be interested in, and that allows me to make a recommendation. And then based on that recommendation, if they decide to go forward with it, we put together a formal proposal. So for this building, for example, we started out with this drawing that came from the architect that showed the area on the roof that they wanted to utilize for solar. But then also on the inside, you have to fit where the different mechanicals are in the building and make sure that everything fits.
Yeah. We have another pipe dropping
through. So are you coming through that space where all the other mechanicals are?
So we already plumbed our main line.
Coolest part of my job is getting a call from somebody saying, I'm ready to go. And sometimes that happens relatively quickly. I mean, I meet somebody who's like, they've been thinking about this for a long time and they finally decided to check it out and they've talked to us and maybe they've talked to some other companies and they've selected us and they said, we're ready to go. And then I have other people, I just signed a contract this past week with somebody that I've been talking with for 4 years. And I met at one of these home show events and we've kept in touch and you know, they weren't ready and there were other things going on in their lives. And then eventually they got to the point that they said, yes, you know, now we're going to go and do this. I try to keep things on a politically neutral basis and focus on the environmental benefits, but also on the financial benefits. And frankly, those two things are similar. I mean, when you talk about somebody being conservative and talk about conservation, they're from the same root word of to conserve. So I'm kind of all about trying to find that middle sensibility.
That was Hal Saville. His story was produced by WESA's Amy Sisk for State Impact Pennsylvania. To hear more of these voices of energy, head to AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Katherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.